the name of the show is The Untrained Eye. Back in the 1960s, the United States had its first orbit of the Earth, and they made pictures. And the ambassador in London thought it would be a cute idea to have the head of the British Flat Earth Society over to the embassy to look at the pictures. The Englishman was a very dry type of fellow, so he looked at the pictures, appreciated them, and then said, "It's amazing how, to the untrained eye, the world looks round." That's why this program is called The Untrained Eye. I'm just looking at the world the way I see it, with many, many years of experience behind me. What you can use, you take. What you can't use, you just forget about. And the subject tonight is the tide of history. The tide of history, I thought originally, was from Jefferson. There is a tide in the affairs of men which, taken at the crest, leads on to fortune. It turns out that Jefferson got that from William Shakespeare. So I stand corrected on that. But if you're planning to get into serious political work, you have to understand that a lot of what you do has to do with the tide of history. You can play regular politics, or you can be a revolutionary. Now let's look at some of the revolutionaries in history. Take Hitler, who's one of the most fascinating ones, according to the number of books that have been written about him. People always talk about what did Hitler have going for him, what kind of talents did he have, and even Winston Churchill, his worst enemy, admitted that Hitler was a great man if greatness and evil go together. So Hitler is a fascinating personality, and certainly the National Socialist Revolution in Germany could never have taken place without him, or and certainly would have taken an entirely different form. You're talking about what did Hitler have going for him. There's a very important thing to remember, and that is what he had going for him was Germany had been defeated in World War I. The Allies had been bent on revenge. Germany had had, in 1923, Germany had an inflation that was so rapid that, and I know people who were in the middle of it, that workers would get their salaries while they were sitting on their bicycles, ride straight to the store and buy things because prices would increase about 20 or 100% an hour. It was a disaster. Now, this inflation was blamed on reparations. Actually, it happened because the socialist government decided to destroy the price system that way. And like all socialist experiments, it was a disaster. And in 1923 was when Hitler had his push in Bavaria, which didn't succeed, but that was a high point in his career. Because at that moment, Germany was in a state of disaster. Then after 1923, things settled down a little. The Nazi Party practically disappeared. The National Socialist Party practically disappeared. I looked in a World Almanac from 1928, and it had a long list of the different political parties in the Reichstag, and I couldn't find the National Socialist Party there. There's a long list of parties with their numbers of seats. One of them said Fascist won, and I thought maybe that was the National Socialist Party. But it was practically non-existent. The National Socialist Party didn't really get going till the Depression hit in 1929, the World Depression. But it was worse for Germany, because Germany was not only hit with a Depression, it was also hit with reparations. They had to send money out while the country was flat on its backside. So things got worse and worse, and the National Socialist Party expanded wildly after that. One thing Hitler had going for him was the worst depression the world has ever known. He had Germany's defeat in World War I. He had another thing, too. He had stupid opponents. The reason that Hitler finally was given the chancellorship, Hindenburg didn't like him, President Hindenburg. But between them, the National Socialists and the Communists held a majority of seats. So a new government would either have to include the Communists or the National Socialists. Now, the Communists could have prevented Hitler's taking power, but they demanded a full share of power if they joined into any coalition. They could have prevented Hitler from taking power by simply voting for any government Hindenburg wanted without asking for anything. And again, you got this weird socialist logic, because in Moscow, they thought that, this is a little hard to explain to people who aren't used to socialist theology, but they felt that Hitler was okay because he represented the petty bourgeois, whereas they represented the future, which was the proletariat, according to Marx. So Hitler would be a short-lived phenomenon, no threat at all. Hitler had the good old socialists in 1923 who caused that inflation to destroy the market system. Then he had the communists in 1933 who had some sort of bad-headed idea about class warfare. And you can't buy opponents like that. Actually, you can. Now, respectable conservatives in America are opponents exactly like that, which the media do, in fact, buy. Point is, Hitler had going for him an enormous and unprecedented situation. He then rode that tide of history to become Führer. Same thing is true of Lenin. Lenin, we've had many, many books written about him, about his intellectualism and his standing forth and all that stuff. But he didn't invent a stupid, weak czar. He didn't invent World War I. He rode the tide. If World War I had not broken out, he would have been one more tired old has-been revolutionary. Although he made a good living at it, he certainly never had to do any work in his life. To be a revolutionary, you have to ride the tide of history. An entirely different revolution, our own, the American Revolution. Now, what happened in 1776 really had nothing to do with the tea tax or any of that stuff. What happened was that America had grown up. And contrary to what people think, it was not a nation of immigrants. In 1776, the white population of America contained a higher percentage of native-born Americans than at any time before or since. That was true in 1789 when the Constitution was written. And the reason that Britain and America were separating had nothing to do with the tea tax. Those were incidents. Tea tax and a less-known ban on expansion west of the Appalachians. What happened was that a new nation had grown up over here, and we resented control from Britain because they really had nothing to do with us. The average American at that time, in 1776, had been born in America. His father had been born in America. His grandfather had been born in America. And his great-grandfather had been born in America. And they had no connection whatever to this British Empire, except that they were required to say they were for it. Now, if that had not occurred, Thomas Jefferson would have been a country gentleman, George Washington would have been a country gentleman, and the founding fathers would have been probably a very productive and forgotten group of people. What they had going with them was the tide of history. That is what revolutions are made of. All right, let's complete it and talk about the French Revolution. The Louis, the Bourbon dynasty that controlled France, couldn't handle, the whole system actually was rotten, but by supporting the American war, France had gotten itself into such a debt that it had to have an assembly to raise new taxes, and that assembly got out of hand. If the French government had been able to handle its own affairs, the French Bourbon, the royalist government, then Robespierre and Napoleon and all these people would have been forgotten by history. The point is, they were there at the right time, and that is what a revolution is made of. Same thing is true today, and it's important for those of us who are looking to the future to realize that there's an enormous difference between politics as it is normally played and revolution. A revolutionary waits for the tide of history and rides it. He's like a surfer. The surfer doesn't create the wave, but he's ready for it. And there are 100 other people who are waiting for the same wave. The champion surfer is the one who is ready, takes that wave, and rides it in. Regular politics, if I can extend that analogy, is sort of like a swimmer. He's not waiting for a wave. He's just sort of flopping around in the water and doing what he can do. He's making his own power. He's not using a wave. And he doesn't expect any spectacular results. He might get a tenth of a second off of a short swim compared to some other competitive swimmer. But he doesn't create the wave. And the person who's going to cause a revolution or who's going to deal in a revolution has to look at the world entirely differently from a person who is playing regular politics. The people who are playing regular politics get drowned when a revolutionary situation occurs. And that is what is really wrong with this whole idea of playing politics until the revolution comes along. Let's talk about the revolution that's coming. Everybody knows that the issue of race is the elephant in the living room. You can call it immigration, you can call it crime, you can call it jobs, you can call it anything. But it keeps coming back to race. Right now, the minority groups in America are sort of like Tonto and the Lone Ranger. I don't know how many of you are old enough to remember the Lone Ranger and his faithful Indian companion, Tonto. And so you have the white liberals and their faithful colored companions who vote for them. That's politics as usual. But as these groups get larger, when they start, as we lately saw the mayor of Los Angeles being elected, a Hispanic being elected there, they are going to stop being the liberals' faithful colored companions. They're going to want their own thing. They're going to start speaking in racial groups. And politicians who are non-racial are going to be lost in the flood and high tide, the way that the other parties in Germany were lost in 1933, the way the other groups in Russia were lost, the way that people who tried to make peace between Britain and America in 1775 were lost, the way that so many moderate politicians ended up going to the guillotine in the French Revolution. They're not prepared for it. So we just have essentially two different groups. One is a group that wants to play politics, and they can show you, well, we gained 4 seats here, 3 seats there. Then you have the people who are looking to the tide. And these are two entirely different groups. In fact, when the revolution comes, you're going to find that the people who played the political game are going to be, whether they're left-wing, right-wing, whatever, they're going to be the worst enemies of the people who are going to lead the revolution. They put a lot of their time and effort into things as they were, and they want to assure everybody that things are still as they were. Europe is going to be about 50% Muslim by the middle of this century. Bill Clinton was making a speech in which he announced about, I forget the year he specified, I think it's 2050, that America would be a majority non-white, and his overwhelmingly white audience applauded wildly. We're supposed to accept that. That's fine. The problem is that these same pea brains who were applauding don't realize that the nature of American politics is going to change with the nature of the American people. And Hispanics consider themselves Hispanics. And we see it all the time. I heard a lot of Democrats and liberals and a lot of Republicans, including Bush, say that when the Republican Party out in California opposed the giving of full welfare and school benefits to illegal aliens, that the Republican Party was cutting its own throat. Now, the old conservative argument was that Hispanics in America who were born here are Americans. Their loyalty is to America. They're taxpayers. They think like everybody else. Sorry about that, gang. The fact is they don't. Their interest is in other Hispanics, and they vote that way. So the Republican Party did, in fact, commit suicide in California because it opposed giving American tax money to illegal aliens. And every liberal commentator and many conservative commentators will say, I told you so. You know that the Hispanics would be upset at the idea of taking the side of Americans versus the side of illegal aliens. They don't put it that way. Again, mine is the untrained eye, remember. Their trained eye, they know how to say, well, Hispanics are worried about discrimination against Hispanics and so forth. But the bottom line is that Hispanics are Hispanic first. They don't have all that much loyalty to a bunch of Anglos who run the United States. I'm talking about the overwhelming majority. I'm not talking about the Hispanics who were here in the 16th century down in Florida. In St. Augustine, they have Spanish names. They'd officially be Hispanics, but they're at least as Southern as I am. Their attitudes are ours. I'm not fool enough. I do speak a fair amount of Spanish. I'm not fool enough to think that Hispanic is one solid unit. But if you're talking about brown skin and Hispanic in general, and you're dealing in politics, regular politics, simple fact of the matter is that they vote for Hispanics, legal, illegal, Nicaraguan, Mexican, whatever. Their concern is other Hispanics, not people who run around with documents that say they're American citizens. You will note that the term, official term in this Hispanic community, for an illegal alien is an undocumented worker. The only difference between somebody who's been in America for 400 years, whose family's been in America for 400 years, or for that matter, an American Indian who's been here longer, and a Hispanic who steps across the border, a Mexican who steps across the border, the only difference is that some bureaucrat or some judge hasn't given him a document. And there's a lot of truth in that, because from the Hispanic point of view, their loyalty looks south. That's why they vote that way. Now, at the moment, no one is going to say that except me. But it's going to come out. It's part of the tide of history. We're going to have to stop talking BS, and we're going to have to start speaking English about these things. Black people are the most loyal voting bloc to Democrats. And down through the years, no one was allowed to say that. It's funny how, in fact, in the last 20 years, everybody recognizes this. Now, a lot of times the problem with the untrained eye is, I remember things that people nowadays honestly can't believe were true. I remember in the 1950s when the standard Republican conservative would walk up to you and say, we're going to get the Negro vote this time. In the 1960s, they said, no, we can't talk about crime. We can't talk about Wallace's issues because we're going to get the Negro vote this time. Then it became the black vote. Now it's the African-American vote. But it's a little hard to believe today that the Republican Party dedicated its entire strategy. It ignored 10 million voters who voted for Wallace in 1968 and devoted its entire strategy to trying to get the, quote, Negro vote, unquote. That sounds so stupid, it's hard to believe. Well, I told you about how Moscow reacted to Hitler. It said Hitler is harmless because he represents, in Marxist theory, he represents the bourgeois class and the proletarian class as part of the future. The prophet Marx said so. Or that the socialists would destroy themselves and the power they had in 1923 in Germany by having a runaway inflation where it took literally several billion marks to buy a loaf of bread. This was nuts, but it was in line with their theory. So, down through the years, I have dealt with this kind of mentality, and all through those years, the Republican Party was going to ignore conservative Southerners. And it was going to get, and also, by the way, conservative Polish steel workers. I worked up in a steel district in Chicago in 1968. I lived in the headquarters. They were Wallaceites. But the Republican Party threw all those votes away because they kept insisting they were going to get the Negro vote. This sounds a bit nutty now, so the socialists, so does most of this stuff. But remember that the people who were talking this crap were getting elected. That is, they were getting elected to leadership in the Republican Party. They were playing politics. Nobody was allowed to say that blacks were simply, in voter terms, slaves of the liberals. No matter what the liberals did was good, because liberals were supposed to be for black people. And that is very insulting to black people, and so nobody would say it. But the way that you don't get insulted for doing something stupid is to stop doing something stupid. It's like the blacks who are always talking about, well, the police pull us over because we're black. Of course they do. That's because the chances of a person who is black having committed a crime is several times as high as that of a white having committed a crime. That's why the police pull you over. That's profiling, is what clues are all about. Now, you can either blame the policeman, or you can blame the criminals who are black who are committing the crimes. I've never seen any black, quote, leader, unquote, once even vaguely criticize the blacks who were committing the crime. No. It's the police who notice that black people are committing crimes. Now, so you can't say that in regular politics, but the thing about regular politics is eventually it stops working. And the present theory is, the tide of history is, people are becoming more cynical. And what we're doing isn't working. And it's going to cause a crisis because our population is going to change. So how do we handle that? Do we get in front of the microphone and get four more votes, or canvass the district, or shake hands with the right people and get in with them? Or do we prepare ourselves to be spokesmen for white people, specifically? The revolutionary will position himself for the wave that will come. He's not really interested in present-day politics. I spent all my years from the 50s until 1980, trying to get conservatives to stop going for the Negro vote and start going for votes they could get. I wrote a book in 1976 called A Plague on Both Your Houses. That was after I had become an honorary Boston Southie, back going up to South Boston. And I had called up the South Boston protesters. They were fighting busing. I've probably forgotten that. A very big national issue, busing in Boston. A judge who sent his son to a private school, Anglo-Saxon, had ordered South Boston's children to be bused into black areas. So the South Boston people were rebelling. All of South Boston was up in arms. Everybody was talking about it. I called in and I said, look, I'm a writer, political consultant. My wife is a legal secretary, and the other of the three of us, called the Populist Forum, is a professional press man. And I said, what do you need? What can we do for you? Well, they were a grassroots protest. They didn't have any writers or press people or anything. And I said, we'll do it free. We'll pay our own way, the whole bit. They were enormously grateful to us. People were always asking me, how did you get in there? Well, the way we got in there was asking what they needed and do it for them. But what I was interested in was the working people who had, and this was long before Wallace and after Wallace. But in 1968, George Wallace ran as the working man, white working man's candidate, wouldn't call that. And in the presidential race between him and Humphrey and Nixon, he picked up 10 million votes. He got as high as 22% of the total vote on one poll. So here was this huge block of voters who wanted conservative Republicans just take over the party, make it anti-crime, fight busing, fight these gut issues. And I wanted to make a coalition between those workers who were called, those people who were called the Wallace Democrats and were sneered at by the press, and the regular conservatives. And I fought, I worked on this for years. And finally, in 1980, the time came. But, in 1980, Reagan smashed the Democrats. The Democrats had controlled both houses of Congress since the 1950s. When Reagan came along, he took the Senate, which was unimaginable before that the Republicans could control a house. And for a whole generation, the Democrats had controlled both houses of Congress. He destroyed Jimmy Carter in the election of 1980. And this coalition I had talked about took place. Bill Rusher, myself, Pat Buchanan, some of these others were the leaders of this thing. And we kept positioning ourselves, and we kept insisting that there couldn't be a compromise. We're going to have to abandon this minority strategy and go for the vote we could get. Well, it worked out in 1980. And as a result, I know that the Reagan Revolution was very disappointing to many of us. I didn't expect any more of it than we got, but we did get the destruction of the Soviet Union. And I will never forget, because I played a part in it, walking across the Moscow River Bridge, right in front of the Kremlin, turning around, and giving the Kremlin the bird. It was one of the best feelings of my life. We tore you people out at last. The Reagan Revolution, though, again, had to wait for its time. Now, in 1973, Nixon was the sort of middle-of-the-road, old-fashioned type Republican. He completely discredited them with Watergate. In 1974, the Republicans suffered a disastrous defeat because of Nixon. Nixon was beaten in 1976. Ford was beaten in 1976. He had been appointed president. By the way, I had predicted that the next president would be appointed. And then, in 1980, Reagan had a great personality. He had a great coalition going here. But it was the tide of history. In 1980, the price of gasoline jumped to unprecedented levels. The inflation rate was going crazy. And it was the first time America had ever had an inflation and a depression at the same time. Normally, the way they got rid of unemployment was to spend money. And the result of that was they would get inflation, but they would get full employment. All of a sudden, in 1980, they had what they called stagflation, stagnation and inflation at the same time. First time that ever happened in America. The inflation rate was approaching 20%. It was a crisis. That tide of history was what gave Reagan his victory. Now, this is not a real revolution. It's called the Reagan Revolution because, by American standards, it's revolutionary. It's nothing like what's coming. It was nothing like what's coming. But the point I want to make is, I was in politics making my living, but I recognized the difference between a revolutionary or a complete change, let's say, which I was looking for, and just playing politics. If I'd just been playing politics, I probably would have gotten more out of it, but it wouldn't have satisfied me. I was fighting for 20 years for this coalition of the working people of America, white working people, who were Democrats, the ethnics in the North and the Southern whites, and the conservatives in the Republican Party. I always had my eye on that for 20 years. I did not play. I played regular politics in the sense that I advised on politics and so forth. But my real interest was always to get this coalition going and to change, to make a fundamental change in the politics. Now, it's going to be a lot bigger change when the racial politics comes in, but it's the same principle. You have to position yourself where you say things that other people won't say. Now, a lot of people say, yes, but there's a lot of pressure on you if you say this, you get in trouble if you say this, and so forth and so on. Well, of course there is. They have laws against saying anything about race in Europe for a very good reason. They know it's the elephant in the living room. They don't want to talk about it. Now, I can't advise Europe. I do. But I don't expect them to take my advice seriously. But in America, we're going to have to be the little group that is practically non-existent politically. If you look at history, the Communist Party or the National Socialist Party, or for that matter, that those demanding independence. In 1775, it was considered an incredibly radical position to just advocate complete American independence. In 1773, you could get in deep trouble for that. And only the rabble-rousers were talking about independence. But the tide of history was moving that way, and those who were moderate ended up out. The ones who got on that side led the revolution. George Washington's way of doing it was sort of interesting. When the shooting started in 1775, I think it was February of 1775, when they started shooting in Massachusetts, a lot of people were arguing that peace could still be made. Independence was still considered a wildly radical position. Patrick Henry made his speech and was accused of treason for it. But the fighting was already going on. George Washington didn't really say anything. He was very quiet in the legislature. He just put on his military uniform, a military uniform of the Virginia militia, and showed up, sitting there. I think he was about 6'3". He was sitting there in his military uniform, and he was saying, "There's a war on. When you clowns stop talking about it, I'm ready to lead it." So it was about as radical a position as you can take, but it was clear enough. He made it clear. So in America today, the untrained eye sees we're moving into racial politics. Those who are presently paid to not talk about racial politics, to downplay it, like you get some hilarious examples. Again, when I explain this 20 years from now, if I'm still around, people won't believe this. Sean Hannity, they were talking about interracial dating, and he said Jesus Christ died on the cross for interracial dating. I'm not sure. That's blasphemous. I wouldn't like to face the judgment with it. On the other hand, I'm not sure O'Reilly didn't trump him on that. Bill O'Reilly said that the founding fathers wanted the government to finance interracial dances because they called this the United States of America. I'm not saying he said that once. I'm saying he said it over and over and over again. He said, United, United. He meant it. You know, anything to stay off the subject of race. The fact of the matter is that the white race is subject to genocide at this time, and everybody knows it. The philosophy of every mainline politician is that the white race has got to go. They call it race. The race problem has got to go. This race problem does not exist in Asia or Africa. Nobody talks about solving the race problem in Africa or Asia by bringing in a bunch of people of another race and integrating them with them. We all know what they're talking about. Every white country, including Ireland and Iceland and Australia, is under pressure to bring in huge numbers of third worlders. Now, there's a lot of open land in Africa that could use some of those third worlders to develop it. And a lot of the countries in Asia are very, very rich. Japan is a lot less crowded than Holland, but it just doesn't come up. We know what they're talking about. Immigration and integration will solve the racial problem by solving the white problem. We all know that. Just nobody's going to say it right now. But the present solution, the present situation, I think, again, revolutionaries can be wrong. More of them die in disappointing old age than they do at the head of governments. But a revolutionary has to say, this can't keep up. Somebody's going to have to say it. Somebody's going to have to stop playing games with it. And somebody's going to have to say, any racist means any white. It's a code word. That's where the revolution will come from. That will be the person who's waiting for the wave to hit. And the wave is going to hit. You cannot take advantage of the wave if you're swimming around in the politics you have right now. So we have to position ourselves. We have to make people get upset with us, but in the right way. We don't want to run around with swastikas and stuff like that. I mean, good Lord, that's ridiculous. That's yesterday. What we need to do is make simple, common sense, untrained eye statements like Hispanics over Hispanics. Let's face it, gang. Let's stop talking crap. Let's face it. Hispanics are for Hispanics. I'm for whites. We have to stop acting like the race issue isn't there. We have to talk about the preservation of white race and the rights of white people. White people, not with some sort of code word. We have to call genocide genocide. We have to say that any racist is a code word, as everybody knows once you talk about it. Any racist is a code word for any white. Making common sense, untrained eye, and very upsetting statements. It's not easy to sell. And you're certainly not going to be listened to a lot until the time comes. But in the meantime, let's just say it. Let's stop being trained. Let's stop being house-trained doggies. Let's stop reading about the Iraq War or whatever it is that everybody's all upset about this week and concentrate on the tide of history that is coming. And that is where revolution comes from. See you next week.